even though today looks clear and sunny, it's a brisk 60 degrees this morning, as we're in the dead of winter here in California. But just like in the summertime, the beach is my favorite place to take a stroll and visit some friends, the type that like to hang out in the water. Of course, whenever I come here, I can't help but be reminded of one of my favorite myths from antiquity, the legend of Atlantis, which was an island kingdom that once allegedly thrived somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, back during the Pleistocene, or Ice Age, around 15,000 years ago, when sea levels were 400 feet lower, and many of our modern islands were much larger, and presently submerged landmasses were above the water and possibly inhabited. The Atlantic is not the only ocean we have on our planet, so let's not forget that the Indian Ocean and this beautiful, tranquil Pacific Ocean are also littered with hundreds of small islands, which many millennia ago may have all been connected when the sea level was much lower. It is frustrating that modern academia fails to take this into account when proposing and mandating their theories for how the world was populated, insisting that hominins in Africa must have walked out tens or hundreds of thousands of years ago, charting their alleged path on a modern map, ignoring the fact that the Earth's topography has undergone numerous geological changes, from periodic pole shifts, ice ages, and other cataclysmic events which mankind seems to have forgotten as we slowly awaken from our collective amnesia. That baby seal was very cute, but here is my friend that I came to see. If you're ever in Santa Monica, make sure to come all the way to the end of the pier, and if you're lucky, you just might get a glimpse at the dolphins, who usually come by early looking for some treats. While I don't ever feed them, the wild dolphins here still like to put on a show for the crowd, showing off their incredible intelligence and endlessly fun personalities. Dolphins are a majestic and diverse group of aquatic mammals, stunningly beautiful, with 40 species still in existence today. Their name originally comes down to us from the Greeks and is interpreted as womb, meaning a fish with a womb. But again, they're indeed mammals, not fish, and very highly intelligent. In fact, the neocortex of many dolphin species contain elongated spindle neurons that, until recently, around 2007, were known only in hominids. And what's even more interesting is that these neurons are found in the area of the dolphin brain that are very near to where they're found in human brains. What you are looking at is a fascinating experiment in which a one-way mirror is used to see if dolphins can recognize themselves. Researchers can see through it from the inside, but the dolphins are shown only their reflections. Now, dolphins don't behave like this, staying in one place and staring, if they simply meet another dolphin. So this behavior strongly suggests that they understand what they are seeing isn't another animal, but themselves. This, like, fin wiggling, for example, is something normally never seen, and it's a good example of what scientists call self-directed behavior. They also seem to like looking inside their mouth or parts of their body, like their belly, where they usually can't see. So this is very interesting. Self-awareness is seen by some to be a sign of highly developed abstract thinking. And this research suggests dolphins do possess self-awareness. Dolphins were very important to the ancient Minoans, judging by artistic evidence, and in Greek myths, they were often seen as helpers of humankind. In fact, many coins from ancient Greece have been found with depictions of a boy like Cupid or a god riding on the back of a dolphin, and they were generally considered good omens when they were spotted. In one myth about Poseidon, dolphin messengers were sent to bring him a nymph that he loved, who he later married. As a reward, he set the dolphin in the sky as a constellation. Later, the god Dionysus was attacked while at sea by a band of pirates, and instead of simply destroying the sea raiders, he transformed them into a pod of dolphins, charging them to rescue any distressed sailors in the ocean. And here we see a depiction of a pirate transforming into a dolphin on some Etruscan pottery from around 500 BC. Here, let's take a closer look. Now, we may have a lot more in common with these magnificent sea mammals than most people are willing to believe, especially when it comes to DNA. In a Sea Grant-funded project, researchers at Texas A&M University were comparing human chromosomes to those of dolphins and were very surprised to find the degree of similarities that the two share. Seema Kumar of the Discovery Channel wrote an article covering these findings and said that they're closer to us than cows, horses, or pigs, despite the fact that they live in the water. David Busby of Texas A&M University adds that, and I quote, "The extent of the genetic similarity came as a real surprise to us. We started looking at these, and it became very obvious to us that every human chromosome had a corollary chromosome in the dolphin," Busby said. He continues, and I quote, "We found that the dolphin genome and the human genome basically are the same. It's just that there's a few chromosomal arrangements that have changed," end of quote. Geneticist Horst Hemeister said that, and I quote, "Dolphins are marine mammals that swim in the ocean, and it was astonishing to learn that we had more in common with the dolphin than with the land mammals." Biochemically, dolphins are still land mammals living in a marine environment. Dolphins are altruistic, compassionate, and incredibly social animals that should be respected and protected. Su Sang Sung, a Chinese oceanologist, is convinced that dolphins are descendants of aliens that came to Earth long ago to seek refuge. Another theory insists that dolphins were the first intelligent creatures on the planet, and that they lived side by side with and passed on their knowledge to the inhabitants of Atlantis. Before World War II, it was still acceptable to speculate about what ancient civilizations may have existed and how they came about. One forgotten example is Augustus Le Plongeon. He was a photographer, archaeologist, and author who studied the pre-Columbian ruins of America, particularly those of the Maya civilization on the northern Yucatan Peninsula. He was also a Freemason, and while he was shunned by mainstream academia, the founder of the Theosophical Society, Madame Helena Blavatsky, drew upon his research for her own theories. His work also influenced Manly P. Hall, the famous occultist, who was a proponent of Le Plongeon's archaeology and even purchased his collection of photos taken on-site in the Yucatan. Even U.S. Congressman Ignatius Donnelly, author of Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, also championed the work of Augustus Le Plongeon and cited his research. Le Plongeon believed that the Maya sites in the Yucatan were the remnants of one of the world's oldest cultures, with civilization then traveling east, first to Atlantis and later to ancient Egypt. He also discovered that the symbols of Freemasonry could be traced to the ancient Maya, and that this ancient knowledge had come to ancient Egypt from the ancient Maya by way of Atlantis. He found mathematical similarities in the architecture at ancient sites, such as the Magician's Pyramid at Uxmal, that he believed had proportions that related to mystic numbers that he stated were used by ancient Masonic master builders. He also noted that some of the proportions were found in tombs in Chaldea, which was absorbed into Babylon, and Etruria, the Etruscans, which were absorbed into Rome, and in ancient Greek structures, and as part of the Great Pyramid in Egypt, and were due, he said, to a Maya influence. The main problem mainstream academia had with his theories was that the chronology of Maya and Egypt established by archaeologists did not fit, as the Maya were demonstrated to have flourished too recently to have been responsible for a cultural diffusion of civilization.
Zoltar, the wise gypsy, has prepared a little poem just for you. Life is mostly froth and bubble. Two things stand alone. Kindness in another's trouble. Courage in your own. And come back to visit Zoltar for more wisdom.
That said, few archaeologists were willing to entertain the idea of a pre-Mayan civilization, which may have originated in what is now a submerged landmass, as sea levels were 300 to 400 feet lower during the antediluvian times, or the late Pleistocene. If one were to imagine what the oceans would look like, with hundreds of feet of water removed, trapped as ice and glaciers elsewhere, such as covering Europe during the Ice Age, then islands such as the Azores in the Atlantic and Hawaii in the Pacific would be mountaintops of much larger areas of dry land above the ancient sea level. This controversial translation of an ancient Maya manuscript is part of the famous collection of Le Plongeon, the Mexican codex known as the Toronto Manuscript, which can be seen in the British Museum. Quote, "In the year of 6 Khan, on the 11 Mulak, in the month Zak, there occurred terrific earthquakes, which continued without interruption until the 13th Chuan. The country of the hills of mud, the land of Mu, was sacrificed. Being twice upheaved, it disappeared during the night, being continually shaken by the fires of the under earth. Being confined, these caused the land to sink and rise several times in various places. At last, the surface gave way, and then 10 countries were torn asunder and scattered. They sank with their 64 million of inhabitants 8,000 years before the writing of this book." While his translations and interpretations have been challenged, Le Plongeon's comparison of the mythology and spiritual belief systems of ancient Mesoamerican civilizations and those of others, from the ancient Egyptians to the early Christians, illustrates just how similar many sacred mysteries are, and just how closely bonded people and communities are, no matter how distant they are in time. Regardless, most anthropologists accepted that the Maya civilization postdated ancient Egypt, and Le Plongeon stood by his theories, and for this reason, few people today have ever heard of his name. Unfortunately, it is not practical to conduct archaeology on the ocean's floor, and so very few in the mainstream consider the possibility of mythology remembered as Atlantis or Mu. Another factor that keeps such ideas suppressed in modern times is one of political correctness. James Churchward was another proponent of ancient submerged continents, such as Mu, which he placed in the Pacific, and in his book, The Lost Continent of Mu, he wrote that, quote, "The dominant race in the land of Mu was a white race, exceedingly handsome people, with clear white or olive skin. Besides this white race, there were other races. They, however, did not dominate." According to Churchward, the white race of Mu colonized all the earth, founded all civilizations and created all ancient monuments. To support this, he quoted the Ramayana and followed Le Plongeon in asserting that the Maya who appeared in that epic are the Mexican Maya, and therefore that there's an ancient Aryan origin for both. In modern anthropology, diffusionist concepts are not permitted, unless a theory is egalitarian, meaning everything and everyone is perfectly equal and spontaneously started out at the same time in an equal way, it is not accepted. With the exception being that the hypothesis be in favor of an Afrocentric origin, then it is not only accepted, but celebrated and financially rewarded with international grants and awards, regardless of genetic or archaeological evidence to the contrary. Now seems like a good time to take a break for a quick bite and food review at Thai Dishes on Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica. I always like to start with a combination seafood soup, which is probably my favorite item on the menu. They have several seafood soups, so you might want to order it in Thai, in which case you ask for Putak soup. That's Putak, and yes, my pronunciation is perfect. It has fish, shrimp, ginger, lemongrass, and is already pretty spicy, even if you request it mild, so be careful. It serves two people, or one hungry anthropologist, and I give this soup 5 stars. The soup is filling, but if you're still hungry, might I suggest the Pad Khi Mao, which is also called flat noodles. The portions are fairly generous, and it tastes very fresh. The shrimp are large, and this one is also pretty spicy, so I give it another 5 stars. With that said, let's get back to the episode. The word Pacific is defined as having a soothing appearance or effect, and while the oceanside can be a place to relax and calm the mind, to an anthropologist, it can also be a reminder of an ancient past that has not always been tranquil, serene, and unperturbed. While there's been a great degree of Christian influence on Mesoamerican mythology over the past 5 centuries, still there are a large number of myths of the New World that have been passed down either in written or oral form that have a striking similarity to ancient cultures across the ocean, well before the arrival of European colonialists. While pre-Columbian flood myths are told in various unique and original ways, depending on the tribe and region, the general idea of a periodic global cataclysmic event, which includes a pattern of cyclical disaster and survival, particularly from a deluge, is consistent wherever one looks. Hernan Cortes was a Spanish conquistador that history remembers as the man who led an expedition that caused the fall of the Aztec Empire in the 16th century, the civilization whose capital city was located at the site of modern-day Mexico City. It was called Tenochtitlan, and when the Europeans arrived, boasted no less than 11 separate distinct languages. Not just separate dialects, but totally different linguistic groups from people of different ethnicities, different cultures, different races. To help dispel any false modern notions that it was an egalitarian society, the family and the tribe of Montezuma, who were considered the nobility, were the only ones that were allowed to wear cotton clothing. The common people and slaves would only wear a simple loincloth, with the penalty of breaking this code being death. The same penalty came if someone from a subordinate class made direct eye contact with the Aztec leader, considered the physical manifestation of the sun god. I bring this up to point out that Mesoamerica was diverse and multicultural before the Europeans arrived, and the pre-Columbian New World was not a Marxist, communist utopia by any stretch of the imagination. One myth comes to mind that was shared among the Aztec and Totonac, an indigenous people of Mexico who maintained quarters in Teotihuacan, which is about 25 miles north of modern Mexico City, and were major producers of vanilla. They relate how a human couple survived a major flood or deluge by hiding in a hollow vessel and start to cook a fish when the water subsides. When the smoke reaches the heavens, the gods become angry and punish them by turning them into dogs or monkeys, depending on the version. The Talapanek and Waxtecs are also among some of the indigenous people native to Mexico around the time that the Spanish arrived. And one myth documented among both tribes was about an ancient deluge with the man and his dog as the sole survivors. But the man finds out that the dog takes the shape of a woman during the day when he's away. The man and the dog woman then repopulate the earth. Maya is a modern collective term for the people of a large region, including southern Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, El Salvador, and Honduras. The term was not used by the indigenous populations themselves, since there was never a common sense of identity or political unity among the distinct populations, societies, and ethnic groups, because they each had their own particular traditions, cultures, and historical identity. That said, a major myth which seems universal and is expressed in the Popol Vuh, a sacred text recounting the mythology and history of the Quiche people, one of the Maya peoples, who inhabit the Guatemalan highlands. In it, the creator gods attempted to create creatures who would worship them three times before finally succeeding in creating a race of humans that would pay proper homage to their creators. The three previous creations were destroyed. The third race of humans carved from wood were destroyed by a flood and then mauled by wild animals. This flood differs from others in that it was not meant as a punishment, but rather a remedy for an earlier faulty creation of mankind. Other Maya flood myths recorded by conquistadors coming from the books of Chilambalam, named after the small Yucatan towns where they were originally kept, holds that the only survivors of the flood were the four deities who took their places as upholders of the four corners of the sky. The Chilambalam also contains poetry, and I'd like to recite a short poem for you now. Eat, eat, so you'll have bread. Drink, drink, so you'll have water. That day, dust will cover the earth. That day, a plague will take over the surface of the earth. That day, a cloud will rise up. That day, a strong, powerful man will take power of the earth. That day, houses will fall in ruins. That day, tender foliage will be destroyed. That day, there will be three signs in the tree. That day, three generations will hang from it. That day, we will rise the battle standard, and the men will disperse in the forest. Ignatius Donnelly, on page 99 of his book Atlantis, The Antediluvian World, cites the story of Coxcox, the Noah of the Mexican cataclysms, who saved himself and his wife, Xochiquetzal, on a raft. Quote, "The most important among the American traditions are the Mexican, for they appear to have been definitively fixed by symbolic and mnemonic paintings before any contact with Europeans. According to these documents, the Noah of the Mexican cataclysm was Coxcox, called by certain people Teocipactli, or Tespi. He had saved himself, together with his wife, Xochiquetzal, in a bark, or, according to other traditions, on a raft made of cypress wood. Paintinos Retrasino, the vessel of Coxcox, have been discovered among the Aztecs, Mixtecs, Zapotecs, Tlaxcaltecs, and Mecocaneses. The tradition of the latter is still more strikingly in conformity with the story as we have it in Genesis and in the Chaldean sources. It tells how Tespi embarked on a spacious vessel with his wife, his children, and several animals and grain, whose preservation was essential to the subsistence of the human race. When the great god Tezcatlipoca decreed that the water should retire, Tespi sent a vulture from the bark. The bird, feeding on the carcasses with which the earth was laden, did not return. Tespi sent out other birds, of which the hummingbird only came back with a leafy branch in its beak. Then Tespi, seeing that the country began to vegetate, left his bark on the mountain of Kalhukan. According to Donnelly, quote, "The document, however, that gives the most valuable information as to the cosmogony of the Mexicans is known as the Codex Vaticanus, from the library where it is preserved. It consists of four symbolic pictures, representing the four ages of the world preceding the actual one. They were copied at Chobula from the manuscript anterior to the conquest, and accompanied by the explanatory commentary of Pedro de los Rios, a Dominican monk who in 1566, less than 50 years after the arrival of Cortes, devoted himself to the research of indigenous traditions as being necessary to his missionary work. There were, according to this document, four ages of the world. The first was an age of giants who were destroyed by famine. The second age ended in conflagration. The third age was an age of monkeys. Then comes the fourth age, Atonatiu, the son of water. It ends by a great inundation, a veritable deluge. All mankind are changed into fish, with the exception of one man and his wife, who saved themselves in a bark made from the trunk of a cypress tree. The picture represents Matlakekiu, goddess of the waters, and consort of Telalok, god of rain, as darting down towards the earth. Coxcox and Coxiquetzal, the two human beings preserved, are seen as seated on a tree trunk and floating in the midst of the waters. This flood is represented as the last cataclysm that devastates the earth. In Mesoamerican mythology, a variety of reasons are given for the occurrence of a flood. Either the world was simply very old and needed to be renewed, or the humans had neglected their duty to adore the gods, or they were punished for a transgression, such as cannibalism. In Mesoamerican myth, the flood was but one of several destructions of the creation, usually the first of three or four cataclysmic events. In a number of the myths, particularly among the Aztec, there were no survivors of the flood and creation had to start from scratch. While other accounts relate that the current humans are descended from a small number of survivors. In some accounts, the survivors transgress against the gods by lighting a fire and consequently are turned into animals. The Tlaxcalan of central Mexico have a legend that tells of men in some parts of the world who had survived the deluge turning into monkeys, then slowly recovering speech and reason. It's interesting to note that I've never come across a myth that tells of humanity evolving from primates or monkeys, but it is usually the other way around, where some of the survivors either take to the trees and become simian, or are turned into monkeys by gods, or mate and interbreed with an animal, such as a monkey, to repopulate the earth. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. You can find my published books on Amazon.com. Thank you to those who support me on Patreon. I also appreciate anyone that shares these videos, so thank you. I look forward to reading your thoughts in the comment section, as always. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.